Now for our feature interview, it's with David Goldman, who recently outed himself as the columnist known as Spengler, whose writing in the Asia Times has become very popular among those of us with a fairly gloomy view of where the West is going at the moment. I asked him the obvious question you'd ask anyone who chose the name Spengler to hide behind: are we all doomed?
No, the West isn't doomed at all, but big parts of it are, and big parts of the East are doomed too. The reason I chose the name Spengler, first of all, was a pure joke, because Asia Times is an Asian publication. To have a columnist with the name of the author of The Clown of the West seemed amusing. But I also wanted to emphasize that there are parts of the world which really are in decline, though surely not all. India and China are not in decline. They seem to be doing very well indeed, and Australia seems quite prosperous, and I think the United States will do all right. But Europe surely is in decline. Demographically, it's a disaster. Russia is in terrible shape. Japan as well. And in fact, the fastest rate of fertility decline and the greatest prospective social crisis is in the Muslim majority countries. There, you might call that a decline of the East.
Which is interesting, because for a lot of people, they see what's going on around the world, the clash of civilizations thesis that Samuel Huntington put forth, and they see Islam as on a mission, on a crusade, as Islam as a civilization is rising, not declining.
If you read what the Islamists actually wrote, say Qutb in Egypt of the 1950s or Hassan al-Banna before him, they're quite convinced that their societies were very fragile and at the edge of breakdown and very likely to cease to be Islamic at all. In fact, probably the most fragile society in the world today is Iran, which, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, has gone from infancy to senility without passing through adolescence. It has a young population that simply has stopped having babies. They have enormous social pathologies, and I think Iran's militancy is a response not to strength but to weakness and fragility.
Looking at what's happening with the burgeoning Muslim populations in Europe and their internal, what appears to be, self-confidence, I'm reminded of the 1890s and the ghost dance phenomenon among the last of the Indian tribes in America. They did this thing called the ghost dance, which they thought would make them invulnerable to bullets, and it was the last sort of Indian rising against the West. Do you think perhaps really what you're saying is this phenomenon of Islamism, this attack on the West, is really a form of ghost dance, a last roll of the dice, because to a certain extent they've looked into the future and they're not in it?
Well, according to the best historical accounts, Sitting Bull was very unlikely to have developed nuclear weapons. So the degree of threat, I think, is entirely incomparable. And we're also talking about a very small population of American aboriginals as opposed to 1.25 billion Muslims, or roughly a fifth of the human race. I wouldn't put it quite so strongly, but what I would say is that countries immersed in traditional society with its certainties and its rigid hierarchy have terrible problems coming to terms with globalization and the modern world. I think it's profoundly evident in Iran, where you've got a young population which has the fertility of an Italy or Germany, which is, say, about 1.5 children per woman, a rate of drug addiction 10 times that of the United States, very high rates of prostitution and other social pathologies. Iran is in danger of social breakdown after a generation, and I think the leaders of Iran, who are trying to maintain what I like to call the Persian pocket empire, are hoping that by raising the Shia, the minority sect of Islam, which they adhere to from Lebanon to Afghanistan, they'll be able to garner enough power to break out as opposed to break down, as it were.
So this aggression we're seeing is not necessarily fueled by confidence, but perhaps by an internal lack of confidence.
Well, this is true, but that doesn't mean it's any less dangerous. For many years, Turkey was referred to as the sick man of Europe all through the second half of the 19th century. That did not deter the Turks from slaughtering perhaps 3 million Christians during and after World War II, Armenians, Greeks and Abyssinians and others. So the danger of the breakdown of Islam is that it will occur very slowly and certain parts of it will become radicalized. Now, I don't mean to argue that all Muslims or all Muslim countries are radical at all. I think the vast majority of the 25 million or so Muslims in Europe really are there for economic reasons and want nothing more to earn a living. The problem is, if you have 10 or 15% who are highly radicalized, that's a minority in Europe of several millions, which represents an enormous threat to European society and has European governments running for cover.
Well, of course, we don't know if there are 10 or 15% that are highly radicalized because we're not even really allowed to ask the question.
Well, that's a terrific problem. We don't have very good numbers on what's happening in Muslim communities. There's a new book by Christopher Caldwell, who's a very broad American journalist, claiming that minarets will sprout out of St. Peter's Cathedral and Islam will take over Europe. I've heard much less alarmist views by any number of European analysts, but I think the point is not whether you have a European Muslim majority and Europe turns into a fair imitation of Saudi Arabia. It's much more that the radicalized minority holds European governments to ransom and threatens to paralyze European society.
You don't need too many incidents of terror for societies and governments to be terrorized.
Well, when societies face a civilizational dead end, many things could happen. The Soviet Union fell without a shot being fired. They simply gave up and decided to become something else. Other societies, for example, the Plains Indians in New Saida during the Ghost Dance, decided to fight until there weren't enough left to fight. They fought essentially to the death. In the case of the highly variegated and enormously differentiated Muslim world, we're talking again about a fifth of humanity. I think you'll see many different responses. Some will successfully modernize, but I think that'll be a minority. Some will simply become resigned and go directly from traditional society to sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And some will become suicide bombers and do terrible things. And the problem is not that all Muslims are radical or all Muslims are evil. I don't mean to say that, but that there is such a large radicalized minority that it probably has support in the numbers of hundreds of millions. And that's quite frightening.
Well, let's look at the other side of this coin, which is European civilization. There seems to have been a collapse, not really in economic power, but certainly a strange collapse in confidence. Right at the height of Europe's apparent triumph, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell, communism was destroyed, the 50-year project of containing communism was successful, and sort of right at that point, Europe seemed to sort of heave a sigh and turn over and seems to be playing dead for some reason.
My thesis, which is certainly not a majority or a particularly popular one, is that human beings don't really like life without the prospect of immortality. In other words, mortality is not really tolerable unless you have the hope of something better. The term secular society, I think in a sense, is an oxymoron because secular societies simply haven't functioned. In those countries where religious faith was really exterminated by communist regimes, you have the lowest birth rates in the world. The population of places like the Ukraine or Belarus or Bulgaria will fall by nearly half by mid-century, and Russia is only slightly behind them. In the most secular European countries, you have extremely low birth rates. And by contrast, if you look at the United States, which is famously the most religious country in the industrial world, you have birth rates at around replacement. Israel, which has a lot of religious people and has sort of a religious basis for being there, has a fertility rate of 3 children per average woman, which is the highest in the industrial world. So there is a correlation, which I think can be demonstrated statistically, between the degree of religious faith or sense of something better than this life and people's taste for life itself.
So secularism, to a certain extent, contains within it the seeds of its own destruction.
I think that's exactly right. Human life, in a sense, is an acquired taste. Life by itself is tragic. It's by definition a failure because we're going to die, and unless we have the sense that there is something better that we can aspire to, it's very difficult to summon up the taste for it and the will to live. So I believe that the destruction of religious life in Europe through two world wars, a response to the horrors of communism and fascism, has really doomed Europe to a ghost existence and a slow decline. I think really the same is true with Japan, with a collapse of its self-confidence and its national religion after World War II.
Does the collapse of Europe as a Western civilization presage the collapse of the West as a whole, or just Europe? Does the West continue to exist elsewhere?
Well, I think the United States will do very well indeed. And Western ideas, remember, are embodied in religious doctrines and culture, which is being absorbed by other places. So I'm not at all pessimistic about the world. For example, if you look at Western high culture, China has 60 million pupils in schools studying classical music, studying instruments.
And in fact, Christianity is very much on the rise in China.
Yes, there are probably 140 million Christians in China. How deep that is and how broad is very hard to tell, because many of them are very recently Christianized and may not have a clear idea of exactly what it means. But surely, given the enormous numbers of people who consider themselves Christians, the potential for the absorption of Western ideals, both in religion and culture, is enormous, and Christianity is by far the fastest growing religion in Africa as well. So just as Christianity has disappeared from its original heartland in the Middle East and moved to Europe, even if Western culture fails in Europe, one hopes that the idea of the sanctity of the individual, which is at the center of Western civilization, will be embraced by other peoples, and these ideas will flourish elsewhere.
The West has often migrated, hasn't it? It's a very malleable civilization. It's not necessarily ethnocentric, as some other civilizations are. It's about ideas, isn't it, and values. It's not just about people and blood and ethnicity.
Well, speaking as a Jew, coming from the people to whom first occurred the idea that the individual was holy and that the weakest and poorest were specially loved by God, which I consider the basis of Western civilization, it's interesting to be in Australia, because if Moses had led the children of Israel to Australia, we would have had very few problems. We would have lived quite happily. But we happened to sit on the land bridge between Europe, Africa, and Asia, right in the middle of everyone's path to everywhere. And I think the point precisely was to make that idea known to all of humanity.
Well, what do you think the future holds for Jews? At the moment, you know, Israel is pretty imperiled. Jews are very much a minority in the West. Should we be talking to evangelical Christians, for example, because Christianity seems to be the core of the West? What should our relationship be with Christians?
Well, one of the great developments of the last 20 and 30 years is the increasing recognition by Christians that Judaism is not simply the fundament of their religion in terms of ideas, but that the Jewish people, as a living witness to these ideas, has in a certain mysterious way a fundamental importance to the health of Christian life. So we've seen not only the well-documented support of evangelical Christians in the United States for the State of Israel, but we've also seen from the Catholic Church, starting with John Paul II, a profound and new kind of sympathy towards the Jewish people, in a sense that God's relation to the Jewish people has never changed and remains in place, Christianity notwithstanding.
For a couple of thousand years, Jews were seen as the quintessential outsider in Western Christendom. Do you think we're moving into a situation now where perhaps Jews can, for the first time in 2,000 years, become insiders and see themselves as insiders, as very much part of Western civilization, even one of the foundation blocks of the West?
I think we're both insiders and outsiders, in the sense that our separateness and our uniqueness are fundamental to the nature of the Jewish people. But in the other sense, we're the quintessential insiders, because the Jewish idea, the idea that God has a special love for the poor and defenseless, which I consider to be the sine qua non of modern democracy, is so fundamentally a Jewish idea that Jews have a special and particularly valuable role to play in the West. And I very much hope Jews will remain deeply engaged in all the countries in which they reside, and help to make that idea palpable and real.
That was David Goldman, a.k.a. Spengler, whose columns in the Asia Times are available online, and you could do worse than to reread them.